Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues here at the Stern Center at Dickinson College. My name is Timothy Tamura, and today I will be the moderator for what is the second installment of the discussion regarding the current economic crisis. I have a couple of housekeeping issues that I would like to interject here at this particular point. The first is that we are going to be having four participants in addition to myself that will be calling in from different locations. For the courtesy of the group, if you could, please turn off your cell phones and pagers. And that will hopefully not interfere with our discussions and the questions that will be coming from you, from other participants, and the answers from our remote panel. The second thing, which is a normal disclosure from anyone in the investment business, is that I believe that these particular opinions are not necessarily those of the institution that are panelists are representing. They are meant to serve to bring forth ideas and thoughts, raise additional questions, and hopefully provide some answers regarding this particular issue. From the standpoint of myself, again, I would like to thank Dickinson College. I would like to thank the folks here at the Clark Forum, Harry and others, for the invitation. I'd like to thank Annette, who I guess is out of the country at this particular point in time, for the invitation to come. I will tell you that in driving in this morning, it is a true pleasure to be here. The markets have been very difficult, and at times I always hope that I will hear that it is an up day, a positive day in the marketplace. But alas, today I heard when I was driving in that it started down approximately 300 at the open, and I think as I walked by one of the monitors here, we were down another 200 and change. So Dickinson is a much more pleasant environment for me than unfortunately my office is today. I'm going to quickly introduce our speakers today with their bio, and I will be able to also show you a picture. In terms of the first of our panelists, Bert Schaefer is a 1987 graduate of Dickinson College. He is a senior Forex trader, foreign exchange trader at Bank of America. He's head of the Bank of America's Global Emerging Market Options business, where they are market makers for clients in currency derivatives in both vanilla, which are basic standard options, as well as exotic products in regional currency pairs. The second of our participants is someone that had participated during the first of these presentations, Hans West. He is part of Investor, which is now Dickinson College's investment office. Dickinson has outsourced the investment of its endowment to a group of folks that are professionals in the investment businesses for other colleges and universities. He is the managing director of Investor. He joined the firm in 2004. Prior to that, he had worked with Alice Handy at the University of Virginia Investment Management Company from June of 2000, where he had co-responsibility for the hedge fund portfolios and managed the fixed income portfolio of the University of Virginia Investment Endowment Funds. He was previously employed as the executive vice president of portfolio management at Dynex and co-head of fixed income for Mentor Investment Group. He has a BS from Virginia Tech and an MBA from the Simon School at the University of Rochester. He's a CFA and is on the board of the Virginia Tech Foundation and on the Investment Advisory Committee for the Virginia Retirement System. Our third is one of my contemporaries, graduating in 1987. It is Jonathan Williams. He's the investment director of PNC Wealth Management and Institutional Investments. He is a senior vice president and investment director, again, for PNC Wealth Management and Institutional Investments. He is responsible for the leadership and direction of all investment activities and for an assigned group of investment professionals. He has over 15 years of financial service experience. Before PNC, he was the chief investment officer at Millennium Wealth and Private Banking Group. He holds the CFA and CFP designations, and he is in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, right down the road. And then finally, on the panel today is Mr. Jim Chambers of the class of 1978. He is a principal with Conundrum Capital Partners. It's a management advisory and investment firm. Formerly, before Conundrum, he was president of Quest Diagnostics. And before that, in 1986 through 1997, he was part of the finance group at Corning, Inc. He lives in Annapolis, Maryland. So those are the four individuals that will be part of today's discussions. And let me just start out by saying again that I know that everyone here has had others suggest to them that this is a truly historic series of events that we are witnessing at this point. And I know, unfortunately, that when people talk about that type of thing, it's usually an overstatement. However, I will tell you that as a student of the market, and now as a participant of the market for almost 30 years, I will tell you that it is truly historic in its scope, in its depth, and the issues that surround it. One of the reasons that I never have a problem talking about this, the whole issue of investments and finance, is that you are not immune to it. And when I chat for a bit on my thoughts about what's going on, I will explain some of that reasoning. But you can't, even at Dickinson, be immune from what's going on to interest rates, to the markets, to housing prices, to jobs, to the economy, to the international marketplace. This is a pervasive issue. And it's impacting everyone, and it's impacting everyone in a multiplicity of ways. And so while you may get tired of talking about it, and while it's depressing at times to talk about what we're going through right now, I think it's better to know how to approach it and what to do and what to think about it than to simply try to ignore it, because, again, some way, in some form, it's going to impact you. I'm going to open it up to each of our speakers for approximately 5 or 10 minutes, however long they want to make some introductory comments about how it's particularly impacting their part of the world, their thoughts on the current situation. And the first, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bert Schaefer, again, the senior foreign exchange options trader from Bank of America, for his comments, his opening comments on this particular financial crisis. Bert?
Thank you very much, Tim. And thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today, as well as how I see things here. As mentioned, I look at things in a very global macro sense in the currency markets. So we have a little bit maybe different perspective. However, there's so much overlap in how everything is related in this point that I think even in more, let's say, less popular areas or maybe less areas that are in the news, such as emerging market currencies, that sometimes they're influencing back through or vice versa through everything else in the market. So with that, I'll try and give a little bit of an overview on where I see things have happened in the currency market, sort of from a top-down aspect. Try and keep things relatively brief, and then stay around for comments when we wrap up here. The first and most obvious thing is a turnaround in the overall general perception and level of the dollar. And in the currency market, we generally talk about the value of the dollar in one broad term, and that gets thrown out in the news and the press in a very broad sense. But roughly what they're talking about is the value of the dollar in a developed world sense. So the dollar as an exchange rate value against the euro, against the British pound, against the Japanese yen, Swiss franc, Canadian dollar, the developed countries for the most part. And emerging markets obviously do trade in the currency world, but they tend to get looked at slightly differently. So for a second, I'll say on the broad G7 major markets, prior to, I'll say, 6 months ago, the sentiment was very, very bearish on the dollar, and that primarily, and that was for quite some time, that primarily, in my opinion, was from a economic view standpoint. It was viewed that our economy was not as strong as other economies globally, and we also did not maintain a interest rate advantage. Our interest rates tended to be lower than some other developed countries and certainly emerging market countries' interest rates as well, which a higher interest rate tends to attract more capital, all things equal. Now, obviously, higher interest rates are for a lot of different reasons, whether it's risk tolerance or interest rate or inflation concerns. But in general, if you have a lower interest rate, you're not attracting as much capital. And that was one reason why the U.S. dollar was not in favor prior to, well, 3, 4, 6 months ago. The recent history is quite the opposite. And I think what we have in markets in general and currencies are certainly no different than that, that we tend to overshoot one way or the other. So one reason why we've had a pullback in a strengthening of the dollar over the past couple months, in my opinion, is that we've had we went too far the other way. The dollar sold off a little bit too much against its trading partners. So we probably were owed back a little bit on that. Some people, we could argue, were a little bit too far this way now. However, I don't think it's quite over yet. So that's one reason. Another reason would be in a pullback for the in the dollar environment is we have a credit crisis that has eased somewhat, but things have led off with a credit crisis in which holding assets and holding dollars, more importantly, were most important. And that's led to, obviously, several investment banks not doing so well recently, as well as other institutions in general. So holding dollars, there's an excess global demand for dollars, and banks didn't want to lend them out to each other. So ways to get it would just be to go out in the foreign exchange market and buy them. We all have to have dollars to fund ourselves as a U.S. financial institution. We have to own them on our balance sheet. And one way to go out and get them is just to go out and buy them. in the market. So we've had a global demand for dollars from that aspect. As equities sold off and as credit markets tightened as well, we've had a overall risk aversion level in the market. So trades that might be a little bit more yield enhanced but entail some risk were less popular recently. And what's the safest place to go? Well, believe it or not, the dollar and the U.S. treasuries are still the safest place to go. So U.S. treasuries in general have rallied. There's been days where they haven't. But that's also led to a global safe haven, if you will, and more of a demand for the dollars. Couple other areas is in the emerging market side, just to touch on that quickly, is we had a lot of people that were invested in either funds in emerging markets or global funds where they were a little bit more concerned or the returns were pulling back a little bit. So as those funds were taken out of mutual funds or hedge funds, those dollars were repatriated as well. So emerging markets tended to accelerate that through, and it does tend to be a snowball effect as well. As more people pull out, returns turn less positive, more negative, and leads to more pullouts. So another reason yet that the dollar is bullish or has had a nice run recently. And lastly, for the dollar perception overall is there's not a lot of better alternatives out there right now. So I mentioned risk aversion, but the European economy, the British economy, the Japanese economy, no one's doing any better. If not, their outlook is not any better than ours at this point. In fact, we might be a little bit ahead of the game as far as a credit crisis and so forth. So we've had a general turn over the past 4 months in dollar bullishness. Personally, I don't think it's over yet. I still think we have a farther to go in this market adjustment overall in a lot of aspects. But from that standpoint, I will I'll leave it go and stay around for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Bert. I will now turn it over to Hans, and I realize that he has a slightly different area of the market that he is familiar with. So I will turn it over to Hans West, again, Managing Director of Investor, for his comments on the current market environment. Hans?
Okay. Thanks. I think coming at this from two ways. One is as an endowment investor, and college endowments in general in the world of institutional investors, you typically think of large pension funds, endowments and foundations, there's sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, you hear a lot about. Endowments have, probably with sovereign wealth funds to some extent, tend to have the longest time horizon through which they view investment opportunities and investment results. I think, endowment investors, like other investors in these markets, have been impacted fairly severely by the downturn that we've had. And, it is indicative of the fact that there are very, very few asset classes or asset types during the last year or so which have really provided any positive returns, really the notable exception being very, very high-grade sovereign debt, noticeably U.S. Treasuries. Obviously, if you have cash, the returns are not high, but it is a positive number, which is, it's hard to say for anything else. And there's typically diversification advantages in large institutional portfolios that in normal times help to ease the downturn in any one type of asset class. But periodically, we have these episodes, and I agree with Tim's opening statement. I agree we are in, a pretty unprecedented episode this time, at least unprecedented in terms of the last 50 or 60 years, in which diversification really hasn't helped. It doesn't matter whether your equities are U.S. equities or equities of companies in foreign countries or in emerging countries. It doesn't matter if the debt you own is from a corporation that has pretty good credit, average credit, below, you know, sort of investment grade credit. They've all have done poorly. And, you know, real estate has done poorly. Commodities were doing well up through the first half of this year, but they have sort of caught up with the rest of the world and have done very poorly over the last 3 to 6 months. Literally, diversification has provided little to no benefit, as I said, with the exception of a few things like treasury bonds. So that's from an endowment standpoint, you know, we're sort of in the boat with everyone else. We're not levered, which gives us a much longer-term perspective on the world. But, you know, kind of stepping back and sort of going back to what does this mean and maybe what has been going on, you know, you hear about it a lot in the paper and in the press about delevering, and that is a big component of this. The world is going through a large delevering, and it's going through a large delevering because it went through an extremely long period of time in which it became levered. Really going back 25 years or so, if you look at, particularly at the U.S., but the U.S. is on various points on the scale relative to other countries, but it certainly is a very dominant player in world GDP and in world financial markets, you know, increased leverage at basically most levels of the economy. Those levels are at the consumer level. Individuals have borrowed more. At the corporate level, companies have borrowed more. And at the government level, has borrowed more. And the sum total of all that leverage has reached a level which the system can't seem to sustain it. And I think, you know, the easiest way to think about the financial markets is to think about them as an ecosystem like any other natural system that's out there. And money and credit is sort of at the core level is the basic link on the food chain. You know, if you were to suddenly go into the world's oceans and cut back drastically on the plankton or other small animals that all the rest of the fish and other creatures in the sea feed on, you know, you would ultimately have some ripple effect up the food chain. I think it's really no different in financial markets. When you take away basic credit and lending, you start having ripple effects that occur. And this has really been, in this instance, a very slow-moving train wreck, for lack of a better term. I mean, it sort of first inkling was back in February of 07, so almost 2 years ago, when a subprime lender called New Century went bankrupt. That caused some upheaval for a while. Things got a little bit better. Then in May or June of that year, some Bear Stearns hedge funds got into trouble. They had been investing in the type of securities that had been issued by New Century and by other subprime lenders. And the subprime lending, and this got dubbed subprime crisis very early, were sort of the first links in the chain that really got broken. They had been lending sort of to the most sensitive borrowers in some cases and at the most egregious levels or most aggressive levels. And so that was the first link to break. And since that time, we've gone through various sort of downturns and somewhat upturns or mini upturns where the financial markets and various entities seem to be going through this rolling problem. You know, we had the world really sort of first really focused on this last summer of 2007 in August. There were several large hedge funds that got into trouble. Equity markets started going down very severely. Credit spreads really started widening severely. And liquidity really started, in general, drying up. You had a little bit of a rebound last fall. It's hard to believe, but equity markets hit their all-time highs just about a year ago, within a few days. And but then sort of going into Christmas in the winter of last year, the problems started to appear again. Then the big linchpins and the thing that everyone wanted to talk about were bond insurers, which are entities that essentially for a certain number of percentage points a year will insure predominantly municipal bonds, bonds like Dickinson College might issue to finance a building or some other type of long-term capital project. But they also had gotten into insuring issues backed by, again, some of these subprime lenders and other asset-backed securities issuers that were rated AAA, and so the fees they collected were not that high, but it was deemed a very secure business. You could do lots of it with a very limited capital base. And once that view came into question, their existence came into question, and that causes lots of problems for lots of people who have either owe them money or hope to collect money from them in some case, if you think about any insurance company. If your insurance company is questionable whether they could pay you if your house were to burn down, you might reassess using that insurance company next time your policy comes along. And in many of these cases, the policies aren't renewable. They're sort of lifetime policies. So you would be, you know, worried that if your house burned down, the insurance company wasn't there. You know, that along the same time, sort of the weakest of the large investment banks, that being Bear Stearns, essentially went under. You started to hear a lot of words from federal officials about banks raising capital and needing more capital in financial institutions, and a lot of capital was raised. You know, it, things, again, got better for a little while, and then the next wave hit in September, which was really the most unprecedented. You had, within a 2 or 3 week period, the basically nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were the two largest mortgage insurers, meaning they provide the most insurance for the mortgage market, but also the two largest mortgage investors in the world. Shortly thereafter, you had AIG essentially quasi-taken over by the federal government, even though it's still a public company in the stocks trade. You know, the federal government had to inject a large loan, and not once but twice, into this company to help them try to delever. You also had Lehman Brothers declare bankruptcy, and you had Washington Mutual and Wachovia essentially taken over by other banks under pressure from federal regulators. And, you know, what has come of all this is that credit has, over the last year to year and a half, progressively become harder to get. And if you have got, if you can get it, it has become more expensive, particularly relative to sort of normal benchmarks of things like U.S. Treasuries. And since, as I started off saying, credit is the sort of the grease that makes the wheels go smoothly on world business, you're now finally seeing the impact in what's called the real economy. And, you know, it's our expectation, and I think, you know, a lot of people's expectation, that the economy will have a pretty severe recession of undetermined length and really undetermined depth. You don't think we are going to have a Great Depression-type scenario. I think what federal officials have done thus far has probably prevented that. But that was, you know, you literally had the financial system on the edge of collapse in the last month or so. But longer term, I think we have to view that as a stopgap. The biggest issue continues to be the world has to delever. And the problem with the world trying to delever is when you delever, you can do one of two things. You can take cash flows from your assets and pay down your debt, which is what happens when you buy a house. You know, you make a salary over time, and as the payments come due, you pay it down, and gradually the balances are reduced. Or you can sell the asset. The problem is everyone in the world can't simultaneously want to sell all their assets because there are no buyers and the prices of the assets fall, and that just exacerbates the problem. So governments have stepped in and basically, I'll say, cushioned the time frame under which these assets have to be sold, but I don't believe they have cured the core problem, which is there is too much debt. And that is a much longer term, much more grinded out solution that will probably affect the U.S. economy and the world economy for the next 3 to 10 years. And that is what has now gotten the focus of the news media, et cetera. And so, you know, I think we are in this for a very long slog, and it's, you know, while the credit markets and other financial markets may fade from the headlines over the next several months, at least I hope they do, you know, that economic issue will be here with us much longer.
Thank you. I will now turn it over to Mr. Williams for his introductory thoughts on the current market environment. Again, Jonathan Williams, Investment Director, PNC Wealth Management. Jonathan?
Thanks, Tim. I work with two constituents, really. I work with institutions managing money in the asset value range of about $10 million to $40 million, and then in individual high net worth market space with clients in the neighborhood of about $1 million to $25 million. And they are very different types of constituents. More recently, I've been spending a lot of my time talking people off the ledges And it's been a very challenging time, as the two other speakers had said. You know, there's no place to hide in this market unless you're looking at very, very high-quality debt, typically U.S. Treasuries, and you're not getting compensated very aggressively for the returns you're getting there. But you are getting returns. You know, what we're dealing with now is really another asset bubble. And it's they're all the same in some respects, in that they're fueled by very easy money. And what we're dealing with now is really the hangover from all of the excesses that we saw that were really spawned by 1% Fed funds rates coming out of the latter half of the Greenspan era. And it's well documented what happened and, you know, who's to blame for that. Easy money, aggressive lending practices, irresponsible home buying, buying more home than what we could afford, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, the high degree of leverage and then deleveraging that we're going through right now. You know, really looking at the anatomy and the life cycle of an asset bubble has been really interesting to me. It's kind of like the Lion King with the circle of life. There's a new generation of inexperienced investors that keep coming into the market, you know, as time goes on, and they're the ones that typically get most sucked in to the new thing that you have to be invested in. You know, in the late 1900s or 1990s, rather, it was the internet stocks. More recently, it was, you know, commodities. And now we're seeing, at this point in time, we're really dealing with the midst of the post-bubble meltdown, where asset prices of all kinds are collapsing. And the next thing that follows, as Hans pointed out, is going to be an economic downturn. Of what severity, we don't know at this point. It could be pretty significant. It could last long. There's a lot of uncertainty around it right now. The one thing that is very clear, though, is over time, and like I said before in my opening comment, I deal with, you know, individual investors on the ground. And one of the things that we tend to think about when we're talking with clients is to try to focus on the long term, to try to be patient. In this kind of environment, you're going to have crisis. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. We've had a resilient economy and markets for, you know, since the Great Depression and beyond. Every decade is going to throw us a new thing that we're going to have to contend with. And yet, over that entire period of time and probably well into the future, there's going to be an upward trajectory to the stock market over time. And that's the real key, we think, is to focus clearly on the long term, because in the crisis that we're in now, doing the wrong thing can really hurt. And so what we've been trying to do a lot in the last several months is to convince people to stick to their long-term asset allocation strategies regardless of the turmoil that we're seeing. You can certainly make adjustments amongst the various asset classes that typical investors invest in, you know, to reduce exposure to some of the areas of the market that we anticipate won't do as well, and then to either have very high quality or, you know, have some orientation to things over time that we think are going to come back. So, you know, some of the other things that I would talk about and I would be concerned about is, you know, how do we come out of this from an economic standpoint? Markets typically anticipate the ending of an economic crisis, and it does that by, you know, an unspecified lead time, but typically markets respond positively in advance of an economic recovery. And at some point in time, this economy will recover. The Fed and Treasury and everybody else is putting so much fuel and stimulus on the fire out there that at some point in time it's bound to turn. It could be, you know, middle of next year, it could be very late 2009. It's undetermined at this point. But the reality is at some point in time the economy will recover, and in anticipation we would expect, as as always happened in the past, that the markets will recover as well.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. And now, Jim Chambers, our last remote panelist, managing partner, Conundrum Capital Partners. Jim?
Thanks, Tim, very much, and thank you all for coming to the session today. My perspective is a little different from my distinguished colleagues. I don't participate directly in the capital markets every day as they do, and I learned a lot here in the last few minutes, I can assure you. I think Annette was interested in having me participate more to talk a little bit about the Wall Street to Main Street linkage, for lack of better terms. I think what a learning I've had throughout my career, and certainly in the last month or so, is that the impact of things on Wall Street and this kind of economic uncertainty are immediate and very strong on the rest of the economy. The psychology of expectations in the economy and what's going to happen is that people hunker down, and that's what's happening right now kind of across the economy in many different places, and I hope I can give you a perspective on a few of them from where I sit. But, you know, as people hear this news every day and they're looking at their investment reports, boards and staffs of corporations are thinking about what they have to do. Seniors are looking at their discretionary income and saying, well, wow, it's down a lot. Do I want to spend? People are thinking about job security throughout the economy. And so what happens? So, well, the first thing you do is you stop spending money as fast as you can, and a lot of people stop investing their money. And the media is obviously all over all this stuff. But let me give you a perspective from my background on how this kind of manifests itself in a number of different areas. First is in large corporations, and I would say large organizations in general right now. There's tremendous uncertainty. As we've heard today, Hans was talking about the ecosystem of the economy. And how the credit greases everything. Well, the credit available to corporations and throughout the economy is very questionable right now. Along with that, people are wondering what their revenues are going to look like as the economy turns down. So the first thing that people look at in corporations is we better start saving our money and we better start looking out next year. The first thing you do is you put spending, any discretionary spending you have, on hold. I'll almost guarantee you here's some things that are happening in corporations virtually everywhere right now. Travel freezes, great restrictions on travel for business, travel and entertainment expense. Capital spending, big projects to build plants, to expand projects. If they're possible to put them on hold, they're probably being put on hold right now. Let's wait and see what's going to happen in the economy. The other thing that happens right now is that we're in the budget cycle for a lot of companies. They're on a calendar fiscal year for 2009. And there's not a lot of financial people that are stepping out, nor salespeople, I'm sure, and being aggressive on their projections for next year, given the environment we're in. So what happens is you say, well, the revenue line might not be there, so we have to attack the expense line, and we'll attack it right now. And the expense line, unfortunately, in many cases, one of the most discretionary things is manpower and cutting jobs, and you're starting to see that across the board right now. We're going to save cash because we don't know what our credit facilities will bring to us, and we don't know what our revenues are going to look like, so we have to hold on to our cash. So that big organizations, I can tell you that even goes for the college, for example. I'm on the trustees and we have a finance committee meeting this Friday. I'm sure we'll be talking about projections on spending and how we can be most conservative going into the future. That's happening in organizations across the country. Retail, I'm involved in the hardware business in Florida. Our sales are down over the last 3 weeks from previous weeks, 6 or 7%. People are still buying, you know, nails and screws and hammers, but they're not buying the big grills. They're not buying patio furniture. They're holding on to their money. So So what's that mean to us as managing that business? Well, we have contingency planning meetings next week. We shut down one store about 3 weeks ago. That can't be blamed on this economic crisis, but we'll have to look at that and see if if each of our stores are able to sustain themselves. We'll certainly look at cutting costs, which means cutting, probably employment in a number of the stores so that we can keep ourselves going. And that's, if you go to restaurants, ask them how they're doing, how's their business. You can see it and feel it in the economy that people aren't spending their money there. Third place, quickly, is I'm involved with private equity. We invest in other companies. We will look at companies from $10 million to $100 million and invest some money in them generally for growth purposes, either for them to buy other companies or expand their operations. What the firm I'm involved with, as well as most others I know, are mostly in a wait-and-see mode on that right now. Let some of these things shake out a little bit. We'll still look at opportunities, but it's very, very hard to get any sense of what fair pricing would be to pay for investments in other organizations right now. You have no idea what's going to be happening to their revenues. So people stop, wait, and see things. That's in that hunker down mode. You see it there as well. And finally, I tell you that you'll even see it around Carlisle. It's in every organization you see around the country, every community, in the not-for-profit sector. One discretionary area of spending is charitable contributions. And unfortunately, as many not-for-profits support people in need and various levels of need, the demand for their services goes up. Just one example to bring this down to right back to what Tim said about how pervasive this is in the economy is our local homeless shelter in Annapolis here has seen their requests for bag lunches, simply lunches at noontime, triple in the last 3 weeks. And they say they're seeing a lot more security guards out of work. They're seeing people from the food service industry that are out of work. Their shelves are cleared of food, so they put out broad-based pleas for food. So that is, it feels like the Wall Street capital markets can be far away from all of us, but that kind of stuff hits us in every one of every community we have and we live in and participate in right now. And that same organization says demand for you to help with you. They help with utility payments at the homeless shelter. And people stand in line to get some payment to help them make their utility payments. And the line is down the block now. And they're seeing white-collar people come and get assistance. But this is being felt throughout the economy, and it is, like the other speakers said, going to take a while to sort out, unfortunately. And we have to see some stability in the markets before people are willing to step out at all. So that's all I have, Tim, and thank you again for the opportunity.
Okay, Jim, thank you. Let me make a couple of quick points. When Annette and Harry and the others asked me to come to Dickinson and that there would be an hour forum, I was a little concerned because the truth is that I could easily speak for a couple of hours on this particular issue. I've tried to bring my thoughts down to just a couple of minutes. You have to understand that in my current world, as president and chief investment officer of McGlynn Capital Management and Why I'm Missing, I'm involved in these discussions on a daily basis multiple times. And also, as an instructor in the finance group at Lehigh, I spend an awful lot of time with the students trying to bridge the gap between what they know theoretically about finance and the world and how life is playing out once they get out there. So in terms of my comments, what I'd like to do is take you up maybe 30,000 feet. Sometimes, because of the way that it's being presented to us, we're just inundated with trees, comments about on various programs and initiatives and individual concerns. So what I'd like to do again is take you up and talk about four very quick points and give you the 30,000 feet perspective on those. And Hans, in particular, touched on the first issue that I want to talk about. The U.S. post-World War II has been involved in a debt cycle, and it has been continuously upwards. There has been a steady progression of debt that is being added into our system, either at the personal level, at the corporate level, or at the federal level. And a lot of folks in the investment business talk about it as a debt super cycle. And unfortunately, cycles have two sides. They have an upside, but they also have a downside. And while this is a secular phenomenon, again, post-World War II period, where you've seen this steady rise in debt, you go through these cyclical turning points, and we're going through one now. And it is natural. It is natural to go through a period of time where debt builds up and then has to be worked down. It happened multiple times over the course of the last couple of decades. And each time, thank goodness, we've had some folks either in Washington or at the Fed that have lent a helping hand to help ease some of the situation that plays out when you go through a downside of the debt cycle. The second point that I want to make is that, and I brought this book, and I know that our panelists can't see, but this is the book that when my kids were born, I gave them. Manias, Panics, and Crashes, A History of Financial Crises by Charles Kindleberger out of MIT. It's something that I believe everybody needs to read. And what's so interesting about Kindleberger and why I think that everyone needs to think about it is that he gives you countless numbers of examples of financial crises that have taken place over the course of history. And what's interesting, as an economic historian, he shows that there is a pattern that evolves in these particular crises. And in this particular case, it's not unique. It has all the earmarks of past episodes. And what he specifically talks about when he outlines these particular issues is, and I'm not going to go through all of his steps, there's six or seven steps, but the first is that there's some sort of displacement event. Something happens that gets people excited and thinking about something. And some folks now thinking about the real estate issue, and I realize in some cases now it may be a stretch, have suggested that maybe it was what's been happening in China and India and some of the developing countries and the enthusiasm that global capitalism is canvassing the world with. But after this displacement, something happens, and there is a new era thinking. And what I want to tell you is that what's so interesting about what we're experiencing now is as much a function of psychology as anything. In this new era that we just gone through, for some reason, and we could go through the whole audience here and everybody could give me two or three or four reasons and they could be different from everybody else's. In this particular case, real estate took on a life of its own. For some reason, people believed that real estate was going to go up forever. And there was not going to be a downside. And whether it was the commentators on the news or CNBC or our friends in the neighborhood, psychology took hold of this. And it played into a mania. The unfortunate thing is, in concert with this debt super cycle, you've had participation through the debt markets in the mortgage world and some other areas into this mania of epic proportions. And so, unlike the tech bubble of a couple of years ago, this one's going to hurt a lot more people. The interesting thing is that we all know that after you come through the downside of the debt super cycle, down cycle, and also the bursting of one of these bubbles, there is an economic slowdown. There is some sort of recession. The question is, how long and how deep? The third point I'd like to make is a lot of people, when I talk to them about what's going on now, say to me, well, it's finance or it's accounting or investment banking, and I don't see how I really can have any sort of thought or anything to add to what's going on. And what I would tell you is, as students at Dickinson and faculty here at Dickinson, I think there are so many ways to approach what's going on right now in a true liberal arts sense. The first, again, I will argue that so much of what's going on has a basis in psychology. And the real question is, why is it that psychology, every couple of years, seems to grab onto a new concept and take it and run with it? From a sociology standpoint, I would ask the question, why is it that it seems to become pervasive over not just a couple of people, but over society? A lot of people, it's not just in Philadelphia or in California or in Florida, bought into this whole housing real estate. It became a very pervasive bubble. And of course, not only here, but overseas. Mathematically, I'm amazed when I go to Lehigh to see the level of mathematical sophistication. These people are statisticians and econometricians and mathematics like you've not seen before. But what's interesting is why the models on Wall Street and in the investment banking operations in general can't pick up what's going on. Why they're not sophisticated enough to add in psychology or sociological issues into their mathematical models. It's very interesting. There was a presentation done not too long ago at the Yale Investment Club by the former chief economic officer from Freddie Mac. They basically were using a 13.4% decline in housing prices. At that point in time, their model stopped working when it went below that. There are so many other variables. Greenspan and others, Bernanke, Greenspan, and others have talked about how the mathematical models are insufficient. Policy issues. I know Dickinson has a big policy group and political science initiatives. How can the housing initiatives that were fostered by so many in Washington have gone so far afield and turned out so poorly for so many? Was there something in terms of the unintended consequences of policy or some of the initiatives? And I just go down through the list of so many areas that a liberal arts individual could attack this particular problem. The last, and of course foremost, is history. Kindleberger is an economic historian. And if you look through history, could we understand better how to work in these particular environments when they show up? The last point, and I will make it brief, is I guess when you are involved in a situation like this, you understand how negative the implications are. Jim, for example, talking about the stresses on the real economy. They're real, and they're going to get worse. The question is, how bad? And so from the standpoint of the folks that are out there talking about what needs to be done right now, there needs to be short-term initiatives. One of the things that I learned over the 25 years of being in this business and talking with a lot of very bright people on the outside is there isn't an easy answer. There's not somebody in Madison, Wisconsin, who has the answer to how to solve this. It was very interesting. Years ago, I had lunch with Larry Summers. And people were asking him all kinds of questions about the economy and about the dollar and about all these different issues. I was amazed at the number of times that he honestly looked at the person and said, I don't know. So when people look at what's going on now in Washington and what's going on from the Fed and from the administration in terms of solving this problem and saying do something, the answer is they are, but they don't really have the exact answer of what to do. But what's important is you've got to do something. And I think anyone who talked about in a short-term sense, if we didn't act, there was a chance that the siege that you saw and experienced in the financial markets would have taken us down into a much greater economic recession than what we are going to experience. And I think a couple of our panelists talked about the Great Depression as being the predecessor event that we don't want to experience. Policy initiatives at that time were inadequate and wrong, and you saw what happened. So the question is, something needs to be done. Paulson, Bernanke, and the others, they're going to try to pull every lever possible. What's interesting about the debt supercycle is as we go through these iterations, just like the guy behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, you got to start pulling a lot more levers. And that's what they're doing right now. And eventually something's going to take hold. And of course, the recession will end, as the panelists have indicated. It always has. But what's important right now from a policy standpoint and a political science standpoint, and where hopefully Dickinson graduates will go out and have an input, is I think this allows us now to rethink some of the bigger issues from a policy standpoint, and particularly with respect to finance. Can there be things that are done to help people navigate some of these financial questions that they have? One of the most interesting things I find is that people, even though it's so such an important part of their life, they're not as financially sophisticated as they need to be to make investment decisions, to make mortgage decisions, to make insurance decisions. And so what is important, I think, is that the policy initiatives now can begin to take hold that can help sidestep some of these issues down the road. And I will tell you, in terms of what you may be thinking, in terms of a question, give me one example. I don't think you need to have, in Berks County, we have 22 banking institutions. You don't need to have 44 different types of adjustable rate mortgages and 66 different types of fixed rate mortgages, with disclosures that are page after page after page that very few people, if any, read, and very few people, even after reading them, understand. One of the things I would advocate, and I've been walking around to different meetings, suggesting that making mortgages much more conventional and standardized would help sidestep some of the issues that you're experiencing now. Because we're running low on time, if we haven't run out of time, what I'm going to do is ask if there is anybody part of the audience that has any questions for any of the panelists. I would, and I apologize for surprising you guys like this, but if there are any questions to ask the panelists, we will pass around the mic. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Mike Poulton. I'm with IB&M here at Dickinson. You say that one of the problems is that people who are borrowing money may not understand what they're borrowing. And therefore, to simplify that process in terms of standardized mortgage forms and so on, and all of us in this room who bought houses have tried to read through that 40 pages and then finally just signed it. My question is, well, what about all the CEOs and everybody else who were borrowing huge amounts of money on things that they didn't understand. Who is really guilty here? All of the individuals who are buying houses are guys who are investing a whole bunch of money on you know, using instruments they truly didn't understand and leveraging them far more than any homeowner would ever dream of. It's just it's strange to me that we'd start with the home buyer rather than starting with the CEO.
Given that question was directed at me, I'll turn it over to any of the other panelists that would like to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I this is Hans West. I think you're right in a broader sense. I think borrowing lots of money, particularly money that can be recalled from the person that lent it to you on any asset, above a very relatively low level, is a bad idea in general. The institutions that tend to get away with it over long periods of time are banks. Banks used to not get away with it because there was no deposit insurance, and periodically this country would go through a depression about every 20 or 30 years or so because you would have a run on the bank. No financial institution, whether it's your money market funds, the bank down the street, anywhere, can have all the people that have money in those accounts withdraw it. And whether it's investing in very exotic derivatives, which I agree, the CEOs probably didn't understand them. In fact, I find it hard to believe that the CEO of any large multinational financial institution really has a good grasp on what their institution is doing, other than by instilling very core policies in the people that run those areas and them basically instilling a culture in the people below them, and that even that is not foolproof, because at some level, leverage is dangerous. I mean, Warren Buffett is famous for saying, smart people generally over time can become wealthy. Smart people who use leverage are almost guaranteed at some point to become poor, because you cannot totally factor in every condition that can come about in the market. And many of the people doing, you know, the sort of the headline things that you hear about are no different than offering insurance on some very distant and very low probability and assumed zero probability in some case, weather event or other type of event. There is some probability every year that a large, massive, you know, destructive hurricane hits Long Island in the northeast of the United States and causes several $100 billion worth of damage. It doesn't happen very often. It may happen only every 250 years. But there's some small probability. And over time, if you have any probability, the cumulative probability starts to get to 1 if you extend the time frame long enough. And a lot of what has happened is the probabilities were wrong and the assumptions made when borrowing the money were wrong. And the amounts that were borrowed, whether it was at the consumer level, the corporate level, or at the financial institution level, they always turn out to be wrong because, as Tim said back in his original thing, the psychology and the mindset, it tends to undervalue those outcomes in good times and probably overvalues them in bad times, like now.
I wanted to make a comment. This is Jonathan. During the discussion, why don't mathematical models work? Why don't we pay attention to them? And, you know, I think it's, in a lot of ways, it's rooted in our human frailty and the emotions that we carry. You know, we have to experience the pain firsthand in order to learn the lessons. And you can tell a two-year-old 1,000 times not to do certain things, but because it's going to hurt them, but they're still going to touch the stove and they're still going to burn their hand, and then they won't do it again. So those are the kinds of lessons that are hard, and those are the painful lessons that we're learning now, or some people are learning now for the first time. And that's one of the other comments that I wanted to make with regard to the bubbles. You know, a lot of times it is the new generation of inexperienced investors that come in and really fuel the excesses. Humans in general operate in a herd mentality. We as people don't want to be left behind. And you know, if somebody else down the street, the Joneses, like they always say, you got to keep up with the Joneses. If the Joneses got that new 4,000-square-foot home, don't we want one too? Why don't we deserve it? And, you know, we take out that loan that we really need to stretch to qualify for, and, you know, it's an interest-only loan, and you've got a low teaser rate, and you could do it. The world's going to get better for you. You're going to have a better job. Home prices are going to appreciate. So, you know, we crowd into that thing that we can ill afford, and before you know it, you're in the midst of a tremendous crisis. You know, I remember about 2 years ago, I was with a couple of friends of mine. I'm in my very early 40s, and during me or my friends and I, our entire adult lives, real estate has done nothing but go up, other than maybe a brief period of time in the, I guess it's probably the mid-90s. You know, real estate had done nothing but go up. So, you know, why be invested in other types of things when you can borrow and buy real estate? Because it always goes up. That's how you get rich. You know, and I remember thinking, that's not the way that I'm going to try to address this situation. And, you know, you try to protect yourself and avoid some of the excesses, and hopefully over a long period of time that'll be good for you. You know, somebody had commented about Buffett, and certainly he's one that's done a great job of staying out of things that he doesn't understand. And if we could all learn that lesson from his experiences, that would be wonderful. But back to my opening comment there, we have to really experience the pain firsthand in order to avoid it the next time around.
One of the benefits of being able to ask the other panelists to answer the question is to give yourself a chance to think of the answer. And but this one's relatively easy from where I sit. In answer to that question, you're absolutely correct. My thought on the more conventional mortgages is that there's just simply a lot of people who very innocently went in and borrowed money in very unique ways with bells and whistles on these mortgages, and they're getting hit with that. They didn't quite understand, and the disclosures were not fair and adequate to highlight what the issues were. So I completely agree that there needs to be something done there, but that's not the biggest problem. Your comment about the corporations and the other entities, what's so indicative of what's going on is that the markets were unregulated in a lot of the areas, and one of the specific areas was CDS, the debt swaps, where basically, and I know most of you have heard it discussed, it allowed people to basically take out insurance policies on whether somebody unrelated to you, I'm talking in a corporate sense, was going to make good on a payment. The interesting thing is that these financial institutions that were involved weren't just involved in these on one layer. They were involved in these on so many interlocking layers that the market is trillions of dollars in size. What's also interesting and very sad is that as Lehman is blowing up and some of these default swaps are coming due, we're only finding out at the maturities who even owns them. The last thing I will tell you is the thing that I'm asked a lot is, and our panelists all alluded to this, this crisis has been slow moving. It's been going on now for well over a year. The markets peaked in October 13th in the public equity markets and have been kind of grinding down since. Why didn't the Lehmans and the Merrills and the other investment bankers do something? The interesting thing is they were holding on to securities that they discovered weren't worth what they had on the books and weren't worth what they had on the books to anybody else. They couldn't get rid of them. You don't want to run an institution that's leveraged, putting together these esoteric instruments that really don't have a market, Nobody knows who's on the other side. And if they ever default, again, cause untold problems to so many. There has to be some regulation. The only fear, of course, is, and in terms of the ending of the answer to Mike, this question, is as long as regulation doesn't go too far. But regulation is definitely needed in some of these. I am getting the signal that we have run out of time, and I would just like to, again, thank all the participants across the country for telephoning in with their commentary. I'd like to thank Dickinson College, the Clark Forum, and everyone, again, for what has been a good discussion on a very difficult topic. Thank you very much.